Explore 16,000 years of Virginia history. The Virginia Museum of History and Culture offers a variety of exhibitions, public programs, and special events for the whole family. Learn more and plan your visit at virginiahistory.org.
The United States, it's safe to say, was born in debt. A debt so deep that it threatened to destroy the young nation. Thomas Jefferson considered the national debt a monstrous fraud perpetrated against posterity. We all know Jefferson had issues with debt in general. Alexander Hamilton believed debt would help America prosper, and both, as it turns out, were right. In his new book, One Nation Under Debt, which is, of course, available up at our museum shop, and I would mention also, we are now making books for lectures available in advance. You can do this through our website to get them pre-signed, which saves you the time of waiting in line. Well, in his new book, One Nation Under Debt, Robert E. Wright follows our nation's debt from the era of the founding to the credit crisis of today, which we see in the headlines most every single day. He brings to life the key events that shaped the U.S. financial system, and he explains how the actions of our forefathers laid the groundwork for the debt we still carry today. A compelling and witty storyteller, our speaker shows how the past can illuminate current financial woes. Dr. Wright teaches financial history at New York University's Stern School of Business and is also a curator for the Museum of American Finance. He's written numerous articles and books, and he formerly held one of our Mellon Fellowships here at the VHS to do research. In fact, he was up in our reading room before this lecture, doing some research on a newer project. This lecture, I might add, is a program that stems out of our Reynolds Business History Center. So please help me welcome Bob Wright to the VHS, who will speak to us on the subject, One Nation Under Debt, Hamilton, Jefferson, and the History of What We Owe. Bob?
Oh, it is great to be back in the ancient Dominion, which is the old name for the old Dominion. Only in the United States would something a mere 400 years old be considered ancient, but that's neither here nor there. As mentioned, I teach at the Stern School of Business, which is not nearly as strict as it sounds. So when a student presented me with this item here, which he called a Bear Stearns laser pointer, I graciously accepted. Usually I teach at a podium like this, and there's a PowerPoint screen up on the wall, and I will use a laser pointer. And see the red dot right there, right? And without even looking, you know, talk about time series graphs and whatnot. I've taught the same course over 30 times now, so, you know, after a while, you don't even have to look. So the student presents me that, all right, it says, you probably can't see that, it says Bear Stearns on there. He presents me with this laser pointer, and I begin my lecture, and a chart comes up, and I do my usual, right, where I'm pointing. Now, do you see anything up on that wall? Maybe there's a little bit of light right there, yeah? Compared to this? So the students start laughing. They're cracking up hysterically because they know I have this thing. And it turns out, you know, this is as impotent a laser pointer as Bear Stearns was in the mortgage business. Now, I've purposely tried to make you laugh so that I could say the subprime mortgage mess is no laughing matter. In fact, it highlights the importance of knowing history. If just one regulator or one executive at Bear Stearns had called myself, my colleague Richard Silla, or a professor of the history of finance down at UNC, they would have known that six times between the Civil War and World War II, mortgage securitization schemes blew up in the United States. And they all blew up for exactly the same reason, and that was that the mortgage originators did not have any incentive to screen the quality of the borrowers. So what I hope now is that the government calls me or one of us before it's too late regarding the national debt. Now I've been on Lou Dobbs' show twice, his radio show. I'm told that I have a face for radio and a voice for TV. I was also on Larry Kane and Joey Reynolds, and maybe some of you saw me on Virginia this morning, this very morning. But people have accused me of going on these shows because I have a book out about the national debt. And of course, the causation is the reverse. I wrote the book because I'm worried about the debt. And I'm worried about the debt because it's huge. It's very, very big. Some of you, now it looks like most of you, probably remember Ronald Reagan in 1981. When the national debt first hit $1 trillion for the first time, and in his very, you know, folksy sort of way was trying to explain how much $1 trillion was to the average American. And he said it was a stack of $1,000 bills 67 miles high. Well, today the national debt is north of $9.5 trillion, and the largest denomination bill we have is the 100. So by those calculations, a stack of $100 bills representing the national debt would be 6,300 miles high. That's pretty big. That's $31,000 per person, not per family, per individual, per man, woman, child, free and incarcerated, employed, unemployed, per person. Is that a lot? Well, yeah, it is. It's twice the per capita debt, national debt of Canada, for example. What it means is 10 cents of every federal tax dollar that you pay goes to bondholders. And of that $9.5 trillion, about half a trillion is owned by the government of China. And another about $2.6 trillion is owned or is owed, excuse me, to foreigners all told. It's about two-thirds of our GDP, of what our economy creates in value each year. Now, some counter this and say, well, we're fighting a war on terror. And yes, I agree, this is terrifying indeed, because the national debt after the American Revolution, the Civil War, and World War I was only about one-third of GDP. Now, it's true, after World War II, the national debt was actually larger than our GDP for a while. But I find it very hard to believe that OBL and company, if you know who I mean, is half as mighty as the combined forces of Hitler and Tojo combined, or twice as great as the forces of King George III, Jeff Davis, or the Kaiser. Of course, Al-Qaeda is not that powerful. While 9/11 and the occupation of Iraq and the war in Afghanistan certainly has not helped matters, economists tell us that it has cost us only $1 to $2 trillion dollars so far. Yeah, I like that. Now we just throw trillions around as if they were as if they were dollars. So even subtracting the cost of those wars, we would still be $7.5 trillion in hock. And of course, the national debt figures that I'm talking about are just those that take the form of treasury bonds. The federal government has other obligations like Social Security and the various medical and health benefits that run between, and you'll love this, between $50 and $100 trillion dollars. So history can help us out here, I think. The first national debt we incurred for a very, very good cause, and that was winning our independence from Great Britain. After the Constitution was ratified, the big questions were if, how, when, and where to pay the national debt off. And these, of course, became major political issues that pitted the Federalists, led by Alexander Hamilton, against the Democratic Republicans of Thomas Jefferson. Hamilton believed that a moderate national debt was a blessing, and Jefferson, of course, considered any public debt a curse. What I argue in the book is that they were both right, and by implication, of course, both wrong, depending on the length of time one wishes to stress. In the short term, Hamilton was right. The national debt led to the creation of America's first capital markets, sparked a flurry of entrepreneurial activity, including a beet sugar craze that I talk about in some detail in One Nation Under Debt. The capital markets also led to the formation of corporations at a rate that was unprecedented in world history, and this will be the subject of my forthcoming book, Corporation Nation, which I hope will be out in 2012, unless, of course, the Maya were right, in which case it won't matter. The bonds themselves served very useful business functions like providing secondary reserves for banks and insurers and safe investments for artisans, merchants, orphans, widows, and others. The secondary market for government bonds also helped the American people to monitor the federal government via the bond prices that were regularly quoted in major American newspapers from Boston to Charleston, including right here in Richmond. In fact, many Virginians owned federal bonds in the early period. Many of them were urban Federalist merchants and attorneys, but there were also numerous planters, some artisans, and even some women who owned U.S. government bonds. I devote an entire chapter of the book to describing these Virginia bondholders and how the bonds fit into their business strategies and their life overall. Some of the subjects include, and forgive me if I butcher the names, but Jacqueline Ambler, John Blair, James Breckinridge, William Cabell, Paul Carrington, Thomas Christie, Meyer Cohen, Jack Cropper, Robert Gamble, Charles Dabney, who I discovered kept his bonds hidden in his bookcase. And he kept his silver hidden in his shot bag. I wonder if there was a pheasant that ended up with a load of silver by accident. And my favorite of all is George Gilmer, who was a physician and a close friend of Thomas Jefferson. I also discuss, students tell me, far too many others. As students, they don't really appreciate that I'm fighting a lot of erroneous ingrained beliefs. Some major historians who shall remain nameless told me that there were very few bondholders in Virginia or indeed anywhere outside of New York, Boston, and Philadelphia. That's just not correct. I was also told that all of the folks who did own bonds, regardless of where they lived, were evil speculators. And I find it difficult to consider the barely literate William Woolfolk of Caroline County, bankrupt Thomas Chilton of Fauquier County, or Williamsburg cabinetmaker Benjamin Bucktrout as either evil or as speculators. And this is important to the story because Hamilton, asserted that the national debt would be a cement to the Union. And if only a handful of people in New York and Boston and Philadelphia own these things, of course, the power of that insight would be decreased. But in fact, a broad swath of Americans owned federal bonds. And hence, you know, when there were difficult times, and we know we faced many early in our history, the bondholders, of course, supported the federal government. It owed them money, after all. Hamilton realized, though, that too much debt could be disastrous. And contrary to the conventional wisdom, Hamilton absolutely, positively, without a doubt, wanted to pay off the national debt. He just wanted to do much more slowly than the Jeffersonians did. He wanted to spread the repayment out over several decades in order to minimize the impact of the distortionary taxes that would have been necessary to pay the debt off quickly, like Jefferson wanted. So what he did, I discovered, was to build into the first bonds an amortization feature that allowed the government to repay 2% of the principal each year, along with the 6% interest that they paid. The bonds were much like sort of a 30-year mortgage today, where the principal was paid down slowly over time. And the technique worked, as did the efforts of later Treasury secretaries, including Albert Gallatin, who served during both Jefferson administrations and part of Madison's terms as well. By 1834, the national debt, the Revolutionary War debt, plus the subsequent borrowing we did to fight a quasi-war with France, to tackle the Barbary pirates, to buy Louisiana, and to fight a second war of independence had been paid off completely, which is a very, very rare event in human history for a government to completely pay down its indebtedness. But then Jefferson, though long dead, got his revenge. Jefferson thought the debt was a curse because it was morally wrong to burden posterity with debt. He also realized that politicians, especially federal politicians, could not be trusted. The incentive, he realized, was to borrow and spend, and it's a very strong incentive. Because if you borrow to fill the public purse, politicians can do something for voters today at seemingly no cost. And, of course, this is a very good way to get reelected. So in the long term, Jefferson was right. As the federal government paid off its debt, the state governments plunged deeply into debt to build canals of dubious quality or necessity, and several of these states defaulted, and a few, including Mississippi, repudiated. Even New York eventually fell into this trap. We all know about the Grand Canal or the Erie Canal and how successful it was. But what many people don't realize is that New York continued to build canals, so-called feeder canals, running into the main line of the canal, and went deeply into debt in order to do so. But the feeder lines were not profitable. And so New York had to stop their construction and increase taxes in order to dig itself out of that hole. And then the federal government, which had just paid off the national debt, within a few years fell into debt again. It was not a very large debt, but it indeed went into hock again. And then fought a war with Mexico, which was relatively cheap compared to the Civil War, which was to come. And then, of course, the two world wars and the Cold War. And we've also, along the way, fought sundry pseudo-wars on things like poverty and drugs. And we know how those are going. It would be very easy at this point to blame specific politicians like John Murtha of Pennsylvania, the state I currently reside in, for our plight. Mr. Murtha was written up in the Wall Street Journal, in case you don't know, about a year or so ago, won the award, so to speak, for the most pork barrel projects of any legislature legislator. They were so porky that the federal government agencies that received the aid didn't even request it. That's a lot of hog right there. Yeah. But I think rather than blaming politicians, we should, as Jefferson suggested, blame the system, of borrow and spend that has gotten us into this hole and keeps us there. I make some suggestions for radical reform at the end of the book, and they've been scoffed at. So I won't go, much to my chagrin. So I won't go into details on those. And what I'll suggest is that taxpayers' only defense is to use the electoral system to insist on a fiscal responsibility from our elected officials. And this has worked before. It worked in the early Republic when candidates used to compete on how little they were going to spend, it worked after the Civil War. It worked after World War II. It worked again recently in the 1990s. By the end of the 1990s, I was teaching at the University of Virginia at the time, and there were serious policy discussions about what the Federal Reserve was going to do once the national debt had been paid off, because they buy and sell treasuries in order to implement monetary policy. And without treasuries, what would they do? Buy and sell toothpicks or toilet paper? It wasn't clear. Well, needless to say, those discussions have long since ended. The big problem, I think, is the two-party system. Traditionally, we think of the Federalists as the party of big government and the Jeffersonians as the party of small government. But in fact, the Federalists wanted a tiny government, and the Democratic Republicans wanted a minuscule one. Today, the Democrats want a ginormous government, and the Republicans an enormous government. that's why I always cringe when I hear people say that Hamilton wanted a big government. Yeah, compared to what Jefferson wanted. But I think if he were to come back today and rise up from Trinity Church gravesite in Lower Manhattan after saying, "Wow, those are some big buildings," he would he'd be appalled at the size and scope of our government. What we need, I think, is greater efficiency in all that government undertakes. We just don't hear enough of that from politicians. We also need to rethink sort of the borderline between what we need to get from the government and what we need to get from the private sector. And history can help us out here, too, by showing the way to greater privatization of public infrastructure, including roads, bridges, even parks and playgrounds early in our history were private goods owned by businesses rather than by the government. But, of course, the biggest change of all needs to come in our tax system, which is far more bloated and less efficient than the tariffs that paid off the First National Debt. Unfortunately, except perhaps for Lou Dobbs, a tariff is a dirty word these days. But it did do the job early on in that it was relatively easy and cheap to collect. And people did not fully realize that they were paying it because they saw it in the increase in the price of goods, of imported goods that they were buying from the big wholesale merchants, so we need a nice tax like the tariff that is politically palatable to help us to pay down our current burden. Well, thank you for your time and attention, and I believe we have a few minutes for questions.
Dive into the revolutionary stories of Virginia's rebels, rule breakers, and rabble rousers in Revolution Revisited, a podcast from the Virginia Museum of History and Culture. Listen on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.